This is Purple Radio on demand.
Good evening and welcome to a special episode of Who Sock Podcasts. What sort of special episode is it? Why, this is Who's Views, exploring some of the most polarizing, interesting, and divisive views within the society. But hopefully we'll try and keep it a bit low-key, good faith, all that stuff, because what are we discussing? We are actually discussing Out of the Shadows, a lovely review, a lovely in-depth discussion of what it is. But I'm thankfully not alone. I'm joined with Ollie.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Very excited to talk about Out of the Shadows. It's going to be great. I love Out of the Shadows, as we all know. One thing to preface this podcast with is, of course, it is very common knowledge in the society, I think, that I absolutely, I'm trying not to swear here, love Out of the Shadows. That doesn't mean there are no criticisms of it, and this is going to be a critical engagement, and we are going to be both positive and negative about it as we talk about our honest opinions.
That is true. Whatever we say, the spirit of what this series of episodes represents, we absolutely admire, and it's a great thing to listen to re-listen to, and then to discuss and debate about it. Some other things I would recommend. One, spoiler warning. For basically anything related to Doctor Who and in the Out of Shadows universe,
I will recommend if you plan to listen to Out of the Shadows, which you should, and you haven't done yet, then I would hold off on listening to this podcast because we will definitely be spoiling things in great detail. But of course, we will not be spoiling Beyond the Shadows, Legacy of Shadows, or Beyond because. They haven't released yet, so that would be a bit
bad. How would you
bad.
Spoil something that hasn't even come out?
I mean, we are both in the cast of Series 2, and I'm on the prod team of Series 3, so, I mean, we definitely have spoilers.
Spoilers. And as a second thing, there is also the Out of Shadows Confidential. If you want to hear more of the behind-the-scenes things, what people, like, as soon as the episode drops, they were going straight on Out of Shadows Confidential, do give that a listen as well, because don't just take our view as the official Who-Sock view. This is our policy. That's what we are. Yeah. Policy towards.
To be fair, me and Louis both joined the society after Out of the Shadows was like entirely recorded. Mm. I believe. I don't know when they wrapped recording, but like we weren't involved in it at all. If you want to hear the people who are involved in it talking about it, absolutely listen to Out of the Shadows Confidential.
We're the new kids on the block. That's what I'm trying to say. Let's jump straight into Doctor Who Out of the Shadows. It opens with Open Doors, where you got a newly regenerated 14th Doctor crash landing on Earth. And it, specifically, this is in Stockton, not London.
New city.
And it's in a world of the vanishing homeless alongside the sinister Shadow Men. And at the centre of it is a boy who's lost everything, that being Jason Whittaker.
Yeah, I think the character of Jason, I just absolutely love. I think having... I mean, I do think the right way to do... I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages of any way of sort of doing Doctor Who, so to speak. But I think one of the things that, to me, is far better is when it is told from the point of view of the companion, which I think Out of the Shadows, and in particular Open Doors, very much is. And, I mean, this was... I won't go into too much depth because we discussed this in the Open Doors podcast, but I love Jason. I love seeing things from his point of view. I think he's a brilliantly... written and acted character. Well done, Jacob Cook, on both sides of that.
Writer, actor, director. Mm. And,
yeah, and I feel like that there's two things about Jason, which are particular things in this series, where he is homeless and he is gay. And those are both things that are explored quite a lot in the series, and I think done very, very well. I think that's one of the best things about this series, is how those two things are explored in the character of Jason, and how... And obviously they're linked. They're not just two separate things that, oh, he has these things, yeah.
Particularly how these qualities are able to bounce off different characters and different themes in the episode. Mm. Of course, you've got what happens here, where we see that being he is homeless, he's not really looked out for, no one really cares for him, so why would anyone notice that people are going missing around Stockton?
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting, I think, seeing the difference between the character of, for example, the character of Jason being gay compared to the character of Bill being gay. Whereas with Bill, she is gay, but it's not really addressed. It's just something that she is. Whereas with Jason, it's a big part of his story in the sense of that's why he's homeless, because he was kicked out by his dad for being gay. And it's brought up quite a lot. And I think those are both very good ways of doing gay characters. They're very different, but they both really, really work. Yeah, I think it's very effectively done.
I agree. And I like how at the end of this story, Jason realizes, well, I want to do something where, you know, I've got something else to do other than, what was it, nothing, or like expect to die? It was,
yeah.
And again, I'm jumping straight to a future episode here, but the way that Jason describes why he travels with the Doctor, we really do understand it, because you hear all these stories from him. This is a very well thought out character and a very well thought out story.
Yeah.
And of course, how he bounces off the Doctor, I think, is great. The 14th Doctor with Easy Press, I think, is very, very good.
Yeah. I'm always astounded by Easy Press's performance.
There's an excitability behind almost all the performances. Mm. Not necessarily because the story is quite happy. Some of these stories could be quite dark, but the way that Evie approaches the role, I thought, was amazing. Mm.
And I also love, in her characterization, there's something to me quite Matt Smith, also Sylvester McCoy-esque, where on the surface she seems very silly and bubbly and excitable, but then she can get quite dark and manipulative, and she will do what she has to do to get her way, and she will manipulate other characters if she needs to. And it's quite dark, and it can be quite dark, and I think it's really, really good. Yeah, we're very much bouncing around here, but I suppose this is episode one. It introduces these brilliant, brilliant characters. I think Open Doors we're not going to be doing like a full ranking from first favourite episode to 12th favourite, but we're going to be talking about what we think of the episodes relative to each other. And for me, Open Doors is up there as one of my favourite episodes. It's actually my favourite. I love all the two parts of this series in particular, but Open Doors is my favourite single part episode of the series. I think it's just absolutely, like, almost a perfect, like, Doctor companion sort of story arc introduction.
We're getting very excitable here. Something that I do love about the story, and it is something I mentioned in the previous podcast, is that what this story does with a tried and trusted formula, oh no, the TARDIS is locked, oh no, I don't have the sonic screwdriver, who am I, but has its own Durham Hussock spin, that the self-awareness, there's a perfect balance between being self-aware and also being, yes, this is a brand new episode of Doctor Who, can you believe it? I just think it's done very well.
I always think in Evie's speech at the end, when she's going, I always do a speech and there's always some upstart who thinks they're all that in my way. And there's a little bit of me that wonders if it's a little bit too self-aware, but I also think it really works and is incorporated into the speech. It's not just a little quip to admit that they're self-aware. It's central to the speech in a way that I think is very effective.
Personally, I think it's the fact that because it is the first episode, you can get away with it, because there's the feeling of, we could do anything. Anything! Yeah. This could have been placed anywhere and anywhere, but as soon as you flick that first domino, we're in Stockton, you got all the rest of the dominoes fall. And do you know what? I'd say they fall in a pretty good way for all of the series.
Yeah. And I think I wanted to briefly talk about the story arcs that are introduced in this episode. And I think the story arcs in this series are fantastic. I feel like one thing that's often compared with, for example, RTD and Moffat. RTD writes brilliant, real feeling human characters, and the stories are fundamentally about the stories of the characters, whereas Moffat, I also think he writes brilliant characters, and I think he doesn't get enough appreciation for how he writes characters personally, but the thing he's largely primarily known for is he writes very interesting stories that are much more linked throughout the episodes of the series rather than occasional Easter eggs. And I think Jacob manages to do both really, really well. And I suppose RTD and Moffat, the way they'd written, had never quite been done before, because the characters of the companions were never quite as detailed or focused on or fleshed out in Classic Who. And before Moffat, you never had detailed stories like that. So they were pioneers of their things. And Jacob's taken the best things of both of their sort of formulas and sort of smushed them together, I think. And I think it's wonderful.
What do you think of the villain of this story? Because, of course, every... Well, apart from Twice Upon a Time, I'd argue, has a villain. I know I'm going to... Sorry.
We'll have another podcast about Twice Upon a Time. We'll have another. I explain why I like it.
The villain of the story, it's something that, yes, Vashta Narada, oh, it's the shadows. However, it's a spin. It's a spin on a tried and tested formula, shadows, but with a bit of possession, and they're pretty good, particularly the fact that, as I said, spoiler warning, they turn up again, and it's done quite effectively. It's a certain beat. I mean, I know that... Well, what's the series called again?
Out of the Shadows.
Shadows? Dun, dun, dun. Of course it was going to be Shadows.
Mm.
But I think it's done pretty good, these villains.
I think one of the things that I really like about the Shadow Men, particularly in an audio format, is unlike most... I don't know. Unlike like the Vashta Narada, for instance, they do just look like shadows or occasionally look like skeletons in spacesuits. But then if you see the Shadow Kin in Class, I mean, I've not seen Class, but I've seen like what they look like. They're sort of just like reasonable CGI. And I feel like on televised Doctor Who, it would be almost impossible to make the Shadow Men properly scary because you'd have to have some questionable CGI or bad costumes. I feel like it wouldn't quite work. I couldn't imagine a way of it properly working on screen. But in audio format, they have brilliant voices, although some admit it's a little bit hard to tell what they're saying at times, but they have brilliant voices, and the music in Out of Shadows is amazing in general, but I love the Shadow Men's theme. But the fact that you can't see them because it's an audio drama means we have to imagine what they look like. But I think they look much more scary in our imaginations than they ever could on screen. And I think that's one of the... I think they're a brilliant villain for audio.
It was something that I was going to say now. That the fact this is audio, this is an audio series, it lends so much imagination to what it could be. I mean, what does the Minister of War actually look like? I know that we've got a picture of him
on the poster,
but I always viewed him like some sort of like tuxedoed gentleman, like with a, you know, like a proper suit, because he is a minister. He's a very important person by the sound of it. But, you know, of course, what we find out who he really is. Is he really going to be in a suit? I think it's really good, the fact that it was audio. I mean, I like audio things anyway.
I think one of the things that you don't get with film and TV that you get with more with books and audio dramas, which I think is wonderful, is being able to... Everyone having a different interpretation of what things even exactly look like. Everyone will have their own image in their head of what's going on in the story. And I think it's beautiful with stories in general how everyone will have a slightly different interpretation of it and everyone will have their own story. And I think that's exemplified with a book or an audio drama where you can't actually see what's going on outside of your head. And everyone has their own little image. I also imagine him in a tuxedo, though. I will say that I imagine the Minister of War in a tuxedo.
He's a pretty good character. But he doesn't appear yet. He's mentioned.
Yeah, and I think it's set up really nice. I love the fact that the Shadow Men appear out of order. It's very sort of River Song-esque. But I think it really works for me. And I think it's fun. I like when Doctor Who plays with time.
It surprisingly ties the series together a lot better than you'd think it would. Because the episodes actually link together properly, but in an order that, maybe could you listen to Conquest of Sontar before?
Yeah, if you wanted to listen to it from like the Minister of War and the Shadow Man's point of view.
We need a Minister of War spin-off. Please, Jacob, please.
Where he's just like sort of inventing the Sontarans and the Rutans.
Before we move on to next episode R&R, I will say, and I remember discussing this both on the podcast and to Ollie's face, I do find the resolution a bit naff. The whole thing of we need something to defeat the shadow, the darkness. What we need is light. Whoosh, and it's the regeneration energy. I'm not saying that it's bad, and as I said, I can't really do anything to change it. But even on broadcast, I was like, all right, I'm okay with that. But I can't do anything. And also, it's the first episode. Jacob, you could do whatever you want with it. It's the first episode.
To be honest, and I sort of, I completely disagree because, I mean, I like it when you have story when you have solutions that are set up in advance, and she goes from like halfway through the story, how do you defeat a shadow? And Jason goes, with light. And you get a little regeneration sound effect, if I remember correctly. And I really like it. I think it's a very simple solution that the audience can work out, and that's my favourite kind of resolution. The one thing I was never convinced by in the resolution, though, is why would the Shadow Men necessarily tell the truth? In like, why would they all gather there? Like, I don't know. I'm being a bit nitpicky.
I think it's described later on in the whole thing of why Stockton, because they looked into my mind and they saw me in Stockton. I think it's part of the whole bootstrap paradox, the whole loop in time.
I will say, I had a friend of mine who wasn't in Durham, but he listened to Open Doors with me. And when the Unknown Shade is going, we met before on the battlefield, and the Doctor doesn't remember, he was really concerned that the Shadow Men were going to be a pre-Hartnell villain and tying into the Timeless Children. He was going, please tell me it's not. I was like, no.
I thought, like, on the battlefield, oh, you mean with the Brigadier and Morgaine? Maybe. Let's move on to R&R. This is the planet Papalia, home to a luxury resort where the Doctor visits after every regeneration. As she relaxes, Jason investigates, discovering a hidden plot because of all this time the Calipari have been watching. Yes, I am just reading from the description.
On Spotify.
What do you think of this story?
So, I don't know if this is controversial or not. R&R is my least favourite episode of the series. I have nothing massively against it. And I do like I like the anti-capitalist messaging, which is quite present throughout the series. I enjoy that. But I feel like I sort of feel like there's not that much to it. And I feel like what there is to it is fun. But at the same time, it's just sort of like doctor in a pod, extract regeneration energy. Jason's like, no. And then the climax of the end, I think largely because of the audio format for me, I can't actually tell what's going on most of the time. It's a bunch of sound effects of people going, stop creeping, get moving. So it gets a little bit messy, and I can't quite tell what's going on.
I would argue that because this is the second episode, just after The Hive, the first ever episode of Out of the Shadows, it was never going to really live up to, oh my God. Yeah,
I can't believe I've actually said something negative about Out of the Shadows. I'm sorry.
I wouldn't go so far as to say this is the worst one, but I would say that it just goes through the motions. It sets up the whole like relationship between further. Oh, we went to Papalia, didn't we? Yes, we did. The sound design as well is something. There's a lot of, forgive me, listeners.
Credit to the sound editors for creating the octopus Calipari sound effects.
It works, but I'm sort of thinking, very interesting. Is second episodes all that good as a whole? Because as I said, the high of an episode opener, you can't. It's hard to match that with episode two. And merely just looking at them, Tooth and Claw, Shakespeare Code, Fires of Pompeii.
Fires of Pompeii is a good one.
Beast Below, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, Into the Dalek. They all seem sort of hit and miss. Mm. And I think this, I wouldn't say it's more so miss, because, I mean, as a whole, we should probably sum up, this is a very good series.
Oh, yeah.
But I wouldn't, like,
this is far better than any Chibnall series.
I wouldn't reach out to R&R immediately, but the mere concept of the Doctor having, like, a post-regenerative spa outing, I think was really cool, because, I mean, apart from the Zero Room in Castrovalva, I don't think you really see what the Doctor does in that post-regenerative state of, I'm going to relax now.
One thing that's really fun about it to me is it raises the question and it creates speculation, and when you're speculating about something, you know something's gone right, because I think it's just fun. It's fun to speculate about my favorite show, and it raises speculation about, for each particular regeneration, when did the Doctor go? Because it seems to me to be implied that they've never brought a companion before. So did For 10, for instance, did he sort of drop Rose off somewhere between New Earth and Tooth and Claw and go, oh, I'm going to, you can stay here in this little place now. I'm going to just hop in the TARDIS, and he goes on a little spa trip.
There was a reference to the whole cutting off hand thing.
Yes,
you know, this is a new
10 risk. Clearly went there.
So clearly
13 did not go there. Or like when did Eleven go there? Because it's very explicit in that there isn't really any gaps between the 11th Hour and Vampires.
I would argue maybe during, isn't there that thing in the 11th Hour where they arrived 2 years later.
He went to the spa.
I would argue, yes.
He's like, oh, I just wanted a little trip to the moon and back to, no. He went to Popolia.
What this does for the Doctor and Doctor Who lore, I think is really cool. The idea of a resort where you just go after you generate.
Mm. And it ties in in a fun way to Sleep No More. I also like that it doesn't shy away from referencing bad episodes. Because let's be honest, no one likes, I mean, I'm sure there's someone who likes Sleep No More out there, but no one really likes Sleep No More. But I enjoy that being sort of referenced and not just shying away from going, let's just pretend it's not part of the canon.
I also adore, and this is more on the music side, Oliver Hopkins' book. Amazing.
I believe he's Oliver Robbins now.
Generation? No. I love the music. The music is very, very good. There are two main themes that I love. Well, if you exclude the actual theme of the show itself, which is also very good. First, you've got the whole running away music. And I like how they shape it up for different... Like, they did the Georgian version. Oh, I can't believe it. I can't believe that I'm Mighty Madness. We'll get to that. But also, there's the whole... Like, when someone's having a nice, talky conversation... It's just like general background music. I can't remember exactly what it was, but when people are having a conversation, there's just like this nice music in the background. I thought, you know what? That's pretty good.
So much work.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where it's like, this is like a student production. It should be rubbish and low budget. And so much work has been put into everything. And it's insane.
There's lots of talent coming in. And when you pull it all together, it really, really works.
Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I know that I've complained about the sound design of here. That I'm not repeating the noise, but I think the whole sound design here, the music works superbly, and that I think is something.
I will say I do like the character of Bonnie. What was her name? Was it Bonnie? The two Calipari, the Calipari receptionist and her daughter, who was like half Calipari, half human.
Bonnie and Daisy.
Bonnie and Daisy. Yeah, I think they were very well-done characters. I think they suffer from one thing a lot of one-off Doctor Who characters suffer from, is that in order to set up their emotional arc and in order to set up what their character arc is, they have to overshare a bit with the companion and just be like, these are the problems in my life. Hey, my dad's not around. I feel like it doesn't quite feel realistic. And I think I mentioned this in the Time Heist podcast a couple of years ago, that like the character who's lost all of his memories of his family is just randomly sharing this with Clara. And it's a little bit difficult, I think, to do in a way that's natural, but it does feel like she overshares with Jason a bit.
Well, as we say, this is based on Doctor Who.
She's never met.
There must be sharing between the shadow... What would you call this? The shadow universe? The shadow universe in the main show?
In my mind, to me, this universe is canon to the main show, and everything from the Star Beast onwards is a parallel universe. That's the spin-off.
Truly.
Durham Who Audios, I think, is what I would call this.
Truly amazing. Let's move on to Mind Your Manners. Now, we have vastly different opinions on this. 18th century Georgian London, in fact, 1777, all the sevens, play host to the Arist. Arist? I wonder what they're named after. Robots who value decorum over everything else, including human life. Driving them from Earth will take every ounce of rudeness the Doctor and Jason can muster. I adore this story because this is just Doctor Who through and through. It's got the history. It's got the humour. It's got the message. It has the funny characters, the moments, the relationship, like, this is also one of those pseudo-historicals, because there is an alien presence, and it's just Doctor Who through and through. Mm. And if all of After Shadows disappeared into the shadows, I would only want to save Mind Your Manners, because of what it represents, that it was amazing on my first listen, and it still is. I really, 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 really do like it. And I even like how Oliver changes the, not you, Ollie, Oliver changes the music to make it a Georgian sort of sound. It's great. I love it. And I don't understand why my co-host here.
I don't dislike it. It's just not my favorite episode. I think the thing that it does best, and this thing it does do incredibly well, is the sort of politics in my Doctor Who messaging. I think Doctor Who being anti-capitalist is as it should be. I hate you, Kablam. you know, Oxygen's anti-capitalist is fun, and there's plenty written out of the shadows, and I think it's at its best in Mind Your Manners. That is, and just the, you know, like, eat the rich. I think it's incredibly fun. That is my favorite thing about the episode, is the that whole message. I think there's just points in the episode, the reason that I was never as fond of it is there's points in the episode where I'm not quite convinced by the characters' motivations. For example, I don't understand why Lord and Lady Whitehead let the Doctor and Jason in for dinner. Like, they're just like, hey, we're going to stop by. Can we have dinner? Sure.
Decorum.
Is that
guests?
Is that normal in Georgian England to just, like, allow random guests in to have dinner?
I mean, what's more believable, the fact that the Doctor was allowed to come in or the fact that the Arist were allowed to come in?
Well, but there's reasoning given for that. The reasoning being that the Arist are, like, they killed the poor and these are, like, horrible rich people who hate the poor.
If the Doctor turned up on your doorstep, Ollie, would you invite them in for dinner? Regardless of your social status.
If I knew...
Lord Oliver of...
If I knew they were the Doctor, absolutely. But let's be real. From my point of view, it's just a random woman, a random man have turned up on my door and be like, can we have dinner? I'm like, no. What?
They recognise them at the theatre. We love when there's heckling at Shakespeare. Mm.
The other point that doesn't quite convince me is that, you know, Jason and the Doctor go up to these poor kids and be like, hey, do you want to destroy these rich people's homes? Like, I'm sure they would want to do that.
There's motivation. Because
but why do they not usually? Because they might get in trouble with the police. Like, where does that go? Why have they suddenly decided it so...
I don't think there were police back then.
Were there not?
Bobby's 18. There probably were the old versions... The old version of the police, like the Watchmen or the... I can't remember the other name.
But I do think, like, these kids are presumably, like, sort of begging to survive and, you know, they're not doing too good and they just drop everything to go and trash a rich person's house. Like, I'm sure you'd want
Why
to...
Why must you deny the
in that...
The scene at the very end where...
Oh, it's a great scene.
Yeah, you can't see it. You can hear it.
I think it's a... It's a great scene. I'm just not convinced by the kids' motivations to just drop whatever they're doing. And I don't know. It's fun. Like, and I'm sure they would have wanted to. And, like, good on them for doing it, because the horrible rich people deserved it.
Very well. I'll just talk about the Arist for now. The characterization of the Arist are they're really posh robots who went for a holiday. Now, I adore that concept, because they could have done, they're really evil robots. But no, they have their own motivation of, we're going for a holiday. I hear this planet is very posh.
It's a really, it is a very fun premise. Like, when I was reading the episode descriptions before Out of the Shadows release, because they're like posts on social media, this was my favourite premise for an episode.
I also love the fact that, I mean, I said the whole thing of the aristocrats, that's where they got the name. But you've also got characters like Roy L, Prin E, Duque.
I'll tell you what, until now, I didn't actually realise why they were called that, and that makes them even better.
I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but I just find it funny that, yeah, why not just shorten the word Baron to Bar-O? Yep. Why not?
And I love that I didn't even realise that.
It's simple, but it works with that simplicity to have a very fun concept. I love the scene with the spoons where will Jason pick the right spoon to eat the soup?
That's very relatable to, like, going to a Durham formal and there's all these spoons and things and, like, I don't know which spoon I'm supposed to use, which fork I'm supposed to use for dessert and which...
I also quite like the ending as well, particularly because it does sort of set up what goes on in the finale, in which that one of the Aris survived or was somewhere else. It was very much like Power of the Daleks or Tomb, where it's hinting that actually the one of the villains survived and what will happen after. And of course we do eventually, I wouldn't say see, but we hear what happens after.
I think the basic idea of the Arist is really, really fun, and I do love it. I love it as just a whole concept. I do wonder, because it's evident that they look like robots. Do most of the Georgians just not question that there's robots walking around, or are they disguised as humans?
Well, considering you've got the Clockwork Gang going around, eventually Georgians and, you know.
Yeah, but they've got, like, masks on, so they could be people in masks. And, like, they never walk around just in public.
It's a radio thing. Imagine it. Imagine.
Yeah, but I don't know what to imagine, because if I imagine they look like robots...
So close-minded.
If you imagine they look like robots, then it doesn't make sense how everyone just sort of... just doesn't care that they're there, like, until they shoot a laser. And then if I imagine they don't look robots, why does the Doctor go, oh, look, it's a robot?
truly the best questions you're bringing up. Look, it works fine in my head. I can see why you don't like it now.
No, I also think, as much as it's really fun, I'm not convinced by one of the Arists being destroyed by swearing. Clearly they really don't like it, but I feel like whoever built them...
It was 1777. It was a different
poorly
time.
Poorly designed a robot. It was a different time. Destroyed by swearing. Anyway, it is... I sort of have these nitpicks, but, like, it is a fun episode. And if I sit back and don't think about the details too much, it is just really fun. Like, I re-listened to it recently, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to forget about that stuff. It is just really, really fun to listen to and to have, like, Jason and these sort of Georgian homeless kids wrecking the posh rich people's house. And for me, that's the biggest appeal of the episode. And I think I do love that.
My damn ankle, my damn.
And also, I do love the pre-title sequence, randomly. Probably one of the last things we're going to talk about on My New Manners is the pre-title sequence. I think it's one of the best done because it sets up the premise perfectly. I randomly love the sound design of the scream of the person who's killed fading into the titles and into the music.
It's been done before in Trial of a Time Lord, and there's absolutely nothing wrong in doing it again.
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, it's great.
And I think I also... The way the dialogue of the Arist is done in general is brilliant, and the way it's done in particular in that opening sequence, it feels so much like... It feels so real to what, like, bigoted upper-class people generally act and talk like. And the absolute condescension of the way that this Arist is talking to this, like, poor person. Yeah.
Again, the characterization of this is very, very...
The characterization of the Arist is fantastic.
Let's move on to...
Also, I think we'd be remiss to not at least bring up the repressed sailors joke. Oh, also the always dressed for the occasion is rule 1996, which I didn't realize until my most recent re-listen, which is just hilarious.
That's why I think it's good to re-listen to these things, because you do miss out on stuff.
Yeah.
And only if you write them down and keep them in a spreadsheet, then you'll remember.
Out of the Shadows, more than most Doctor Who series, has so many very subtle references, which are so easy to miss, and that makes for such great re-listen value.
Out of service, returning to Earth, the Doctor investigates even more local disappearances, buses vanishing into thin air, under the operation of the computer program... while Jason encounters his ex-boyfriend Damien once again. I also really, really like this. The whole thing of we're returning to Earth, we're seeing what it's like, I think is quite good. But again, Ollie, I think you don't look at this as beautifully, I shall say. As beautifully
this
as
is going to sound like I hate Out of the Shadows now. I think there's three consecutive episodes which I'm a bit meh on, and then after Out of Service I love everything. But we've had three consecutive episodes which I'm slightly less keen on. I don't dislike it. I think it's fun. For me, it for instance, Mind Your Manners, I have nitpicks, but then it's sort of made up for by the really fun, like, kids trashing the rich and the great and the arist. Whereas Out of Service, I have a couple nitpicks, and it doesn't have so much massive redeeming features for me. It's just sort of... For me, I actually don't remember it very well. It's...
Pain.
And I think I remember bits of it, but to me it just feels like a middling episode. Actually, the best thing about it is it introduces Damien, and Damien is a fantastic character.
I really, really enjoy this story. The fact that Jason tries to return to what he's been sort of having a sense of normalcy, you know, okay, I'm back in Stockton, I'm meeting my ex, let's see what will happen. And of course, he's roped back into the experience of the Doctor. Now, I really like the whole thing of buses. Now, of course, Doctor Who does this all the time, where it will be a spin on something already established. Stone angels are now weeping angels, and they'll send you back in time.
Shadows
as well. Buses. Most common thing in the world.
I do like that. That is a fun aspect to the episode.
The way this is done with the whole computers controlling the buses, and it's still in the service of the Minister of War. And I wonder, what is it? Is it program or
the computers are individually called Prog and RAM, and collectively I think they're called program.
I think that was a very good thing. Again, it's the simplicity of it. Oh, why don't we just split up the word? Why don't we make the word shorter?
I do absolutely love Prog and RAM. They're so funny.
They're like a double act, but a computer double act.
Yeah, I do like that it's sort of... because we see AI a lot in sci-fi, and in particular in Doctor Who. And it's obvious in Doctor Who that AI can be sentient. Even in the previous episode, Mind Your Manners, we had sentient robots. And I love that you've gone into, like, it going wrong in a sort of sentient way. It's like sort of split personality kind of thing. And I think it's very fun. It's very fun.
I think as well it was nice to see a spin on the Shadow Men, because before it was shadows possessing... No.
Well, it's like the people are taken over by Shadow.
People are taken
like
over by
Shadows in the shape of people.
That's what I thought was a good idea, because it's working with something already established and an effective villain, giving it that spin, giving it something new to work with, I thought was a pretty good. Even the sunglasses thing, oh, the shadow is hidden in the eyes. Better than other villains trapped in the eyes, I'd argue. The Village of Angels. There's a way of doing it, and I think this works well, even with the added Damien, because sometimes the more and more companions you've got, the more hectic it can be. But Damien and Jason do balance each other quite well. Now, isn't that the fact that the gang split up? Or is it the fact that
I think
they actually work well?
When you compare, for example, Moffat's 11 Amy Rory River to Chibnall's 13 Yaz, Ryan and Graham, the advantage of the way Moffat does it is he introduces not just the characters individually, but the dynamics individually. So we start off with the Doctor River in series 4, and then we get 11 Amy, and then we meet Rory, and we get Amy Rory and 11 Rory. And then later on, we are reintroduced to River, and we get 11 River and Amy River, and then they're not all together until the finale.
There is a build-up.
And whereas with the Chibnall companions, they're all introduced in one go and in the space of one episode. So we're dumped with all these dynamics that don't quite work at the same time. And I think Jacob does it right here, because we're introduced to 14 Jason in Open Doors. And then we meet Damien without the Doctor. Jason and Damien have their own interactions where we see what they're like and how they interact. And then the Doctor meets Damien, and we have Dr. Damien, and we have more Dr. Damien in the next few episodes. And I think it's...
Dr. Damien.
Dr. Damien. I think one of the things this episode does do well is how it ties into the structure of the series. And I think one of the ways it does that well is the introduction of Damien, and the way we have the characters staggered introductions so we get a proper introduction to each dynamic.
Mm,
and
I
also, it ties brilliantly into the characters and it ties brilliantly into the story.
I think there are two things I'd definitely say why this stands out. Hinting at what the Minister of War is doing. In fact, you can hear the voice. You can hear his voice in someone else's. Mm. I absolutely adored that because it's
oh, that was genius sound design.
It's subtle enough to give you a hint of what's going on, but also gives the question of, ooh, is he actually going to appear? Which he almost does.
He has one line, and I think it's a brilliant way of teasing him, especially when he's played by such a good actor. The Minister of War, played by Richard Sharp, is my favourite performance in all of Out of the Shadows. Evie's amazing, Jacob's amazing, they're all amazing, but no, Richard Sharp as the Minister of War is terrifying.
Second thing I'd say, just to wrap up, the sound design of that bus chase is incredible. I don't get why on an audio format it sounds that good, but it works. It works. You've got to get out the box, get out the shadow, get out the shadows, and it works so well. This chase with the bus, with the Doctor leaning out the window and, you know, waving the Sonic, and there are so many things you could do with this series, but decided let's do a bus chase, and it works. I really do enjoy this story.
Also, I opened this by saying I wasn't so keen on Out of Service, and I'm saying everything I love about it. I do think the way it ends with Damien saving Jason? I can't remember which way around it is. Damien saving Jason. Damien saving Jason. And I think that it sets up the finale very nicely, which we'll get into when we talk about the finale. But I've mentioned before on this podcast and on others that I like a solution that is set up earlier on. And the solution to the finale...
Is this Ollie's gun?
We'll get into.
Chekhov's gun.
Ollie's gun. I like solutions that set up earlier in the episode, and this episode sets the solution to finale up 8 episodes before, which is great. I love the things, how it ties into the structure of the series. Just to briefly justify why I'm not so keen on it, I feel most of the elements of the episode itself are just a bit...
We got a meh from Ollie.
I think there's something telling about the fact that it's the episode of the series that I remember the least well.
Fair. Let's move on to the nuclear option, which is our first. This is our first two-parter. Damien's first trip in the TARDIS alongside with the Doctor and Jason brings them face-to-face with the Silurians, with power plant conspiracies underpinning devastating consequences. Now,
we have very opposite opinions of this episode, but the other way round this time.
I don't like this story as much as Ollie, which is annoying because, one, it's the start of a two-parter, but I absolutely adore the second part. And, two, the ending. The ending is just... The ending is what saved the story from being at the bottom of the list for me, but on my re-listen, I did understand what Owain was trying to do because, of course, this wasn't written by Jacob Cook, this was written by Owain Smith. And I think the fact that you've got both the actors of Jason and Damien working on this, it does feel like the same script. It's not like this feels different to the rest of the show.
It's one thing with Doctor Who in general, is it's important, and I've learned this from writing my own script for Series 4. There's an element of you've really got to try and get the tone similar throughout episodes in terms of the way the characters speak and in terms of the way the series is supposed to be. And I think that it's very, very well done here. I think it's especially a difficult... I imagine it would have been an especially difficult thing to do in a series where 10 out of 12 episodes are written by one person and there's one story written by somebody else. And that story wants to not seem like the odd one out. And it doesn't. It feels tonally consistent with the rest of the series.
I think as well, this is very good. Both this story and the next story is great in fleshing out who the Doctor really is. Because, as we're hinting to, and we'll probably get there, the way that the ending works with the Doctor's character, you see... I mean, we've always talked about, oh, the Doctor is very excitable, very approachable. Mm. You'd love to be around the 14th Doctor. But there's a snag. And, oh my God.
This is where we really... This is the first time we actually really see the dark side of the 14th Doctor.
The shadow. I'll be keep making these jokes.
So I think the reason that you don't like this episode and I do, I gather it's largely because I haven't seen the episode which it's quite similar to.
I don't want to be cruel to a wine, but I just feel this is a redo of Silurian's 1970. Now, to be fair, so was, I'd argue, Hungry Earth. The what was it?
Cold Blood.
Cold Blood, Hungry Earth. I can't remember.
Hungry Earth,
which,
Cold
order,
Blood.
Which order? I just think the fact that, the guys are drawing the prehistoric things. Oh, eight Silurians. I just feel that this is a very condensed version of 1970 Silurians.
Can't pitch in here. I've not seen the episode.
But moreover, when I was listening to it, I think this just feels like a preface to what the second part is, which is annoying because I know I've offended a wine. He's already pressed the pause button and got away. But I really, really, really like Antarctica Records. And you can't split the two up. I know we split it up here, but it wasn't really as exciting for me, the nuclear option. I just feel I'm going through the motions. If I want to really, really enjoy Antarctica Records, I've got to listen to this. However, maybe more on re-listens, I will like this more. And then a wine, it'll be my favourite. But the ending is still amazing as well.
I will say, I think I do really like the structure that this episode does particularly well, of having two-parters, the two parts being quite distinct in what they're about, rather than one. I think they both work. I think actually having two parts that are one continuous story and having two parts that are like two separate but linked stories are both structures that really work. But I think the latter is underutilized, and it is utilized well in this story.
I like the whole "we aren't done yet," and
yeah,
maybe if,
it's not something we see a lot in Doctor Who.
Maybe if these stories were a bit, I'm not gonna say better, but a bit more entwined with each other, maybe I'd like the nuclear option better. But my criticism still remains that I don't really find this as an engaging story as the other ones in the series. But I'm not saying this is at the bottom of the pile.
One of the reasons I love this episode is the way it fleshes out the relationship between Jason and Damien. I love them so much. I absolutely love Jason and Damien. They're just such an adorable couple, and I actually really like how they're such a lovely couple, but they're introduced in the previous episode in quite a conflicting way, in the sense that Jason is mad at Damien because Damien's messed up, and it shows that, you know, even in a really lovely relationship like theirs, people will mess up and not be perfect. But I think it's, and you really see that in Out of Service. And you feel a bit like, Damien, you're not done so good here, you silly guy. that's a very strange way of phrasing it. And then in this episode, we see, I mean, actually, even in Out of Service, we see Damien sort of does redeem himself in Out of Service. But you really see it in this one, that Damien is actually, maybe he did mess up, but he is a wonderful person. And they are wonderful for each other. And I love the nuclear option and the following two episodes in establishing their relationship.
I fully agree. I like the characterization of Damien being someone who's messed up, but still has that care for the person he has wronged. And there was a part where, was it Damien was getting tortured? And
Yeah, no, it was...
You feel it.
One of them got slapped by one of the Silurians, and the other was like... There was a conversation after it about how upset it made them, and I felt that was a little bit moving. No, very moving.
I agree. I really do like the characterization of Damien. Let's move on to the ending. My God.
I think when you think of Out of the Shadows, this is like one of the staple things you think of.
It was inevitable that there would be one of those, oh, this is a horrible situation to be in. Oh no, what are we going to do? Don't worry, the Doctor will say... Oh no, the Doctor won't really save everyone. This is inevitable in Doctor Who. There will be some sort of utilitarian thing of, we have to save the most amount of people. We just got to try to minimise the damage as much as we can.
It's a discussion done a lot in Doctor Who, and I think this is one of the best, if not the best, times that it's done.
I just couldn't believe it. The Doctor deflected a tsunami with... some of the Doctor's special things, a bit of a sonic wave. Mm. Well, waves. Even on broadcast, I was blown away.
The writing of the Doctor and Jason's conversation combined with incredible acting, especially Evie's phenomenal, heart-wrenching performance in that moment, it blows me away. Almost as much as it blew away.
It takes you away.
And it was... I think I want to compare this scene for a moment to the fires of Pompeii, when the Doctor makes a similar choice with Donna and destroying Pompeii. And I think there's a lot of... It's fundamentally the same thing of the Doctor decides to save the most amount of lives. But I think it's done far better here, and I want to explain why. First of all, I think you get... you get an amazing conflict between the Doctor and Companion about it. You get... and it has consequences on their relationship. It has consequences in the next episode. And Jason sort of forgives her. But ultimately, it's sort of not just this event, but this sort of thing is Jason's reason for leaving at the end of the series. And I love that. Whereas with the Doctor and Donna in the fires of Pompeii, they just sort of decide to do it. And because they're also going to die too in this thing, it seems much more like noble self-sacrifice. And it feels a lot less cold-hearted.
Noble?
That was not a deliberate pun, but let's say that it was. And it's just like, oh, self-sacrifice. And that seems a bit less interesting because it isn't less of a moral dilemma, but it feels less of one if you're also sacrificing yourself, whereas it feels much more cold-blooded in this scene, which makes it all the more traumatic. And also, you know, we meet people in the Lake District who got flooded and killed. Like, I'm pretty sure in the beginning of the episode, that shopkeeper was one of the people who was killed, right? Was it?
The shopkeeper might have moved by then.
Because as I remember,
3 million credits.
I'm pretty sure, and like you have this wonderful moment with. I'm pretty sure the shopkeeper's in the Lake District. I might be misremembering, but you get this lovely moment with the shopkeeper, and then death. And it's the only thing which would make Fires of Pompeii better is because it's a real historical event. I also feel like in Fires of Pompeii, that's the only way in which Fires of Pompeii is better, in my opinion. Another difference, I think, is in Fires of Pompeii, I'm not quite convinced that it's the only option.
There should have been another way.
It's maybe implied that the volcanoes are about to erupt, but I feel like that's not very clear. Whereas in this, there's literally an oncoming tsunami. You've got maybe minutes. Like, everyone's about to die, and the Doctor has to make a choice. And you know she makes the right choice, and it's horrible. And it's amazingly written and acted, and I can't believe it. And the music, oh my god. And it's just, yeah, I love it so much.
This also gives sort of credence and a proper meaning to the Doctor's actions in the next story, because of the whole thing of, I want to find out who made me do this horrible thing. Because
yeah,
morally
speaking,
yeah, the Doctor,
those actions are not
the Doctor
the
did
doctor,
not want to do. The Doctor didn't like want to do are. That, but the, no. But the Doctor just had to, because you just got to think about this. Oh my God, what am I going to do? I've got minutes. Oh my, I just couldn't believe it. Why?
I've like throughout the Chibnall era, I have never felt that like intense from a Doctor Who episode. And this is like supposed to be like a dumb student production, and it's amazing.
Oh look, it's the Silurian. Oh, we've drowned the Lake District. I'm so sorry, everyone.
Yeah.
Let's move on to the Antarctica Accord. So this is the second part. In the wake of the tragedy, the Doctor, Jason and Damien travel to the South Pole, ready to make their case to a gathering of wary negotiators, each with their own secret to keep. Everyone was guilty. Everyone is guilty of everything.
I think this is one episode that we both love. We both absolutely love the Antarctica Accord.
I really like this. I couldn't believe that Owain would write something like this, where every single thread meant something.
Yeah.
The whole thing with the prophecy. The prophecy. The whole thing with...
Joe, your performance is Zed Ford, iconic.
The relationship with the Silurians and the Sea Devils. With Quinn. I love the character and the motivations of Quinn.
Mm, yeah.
And the whole thing of, what does it mean to be a human? There was a reference to Malthus. That's what it was. Malthus and the whole thing of, we're going to run out of food. And there's like this weird moral debate. Ah, yes, but Malthus was... again, okay.
Which bit was that?
It was with the discussion over, like, the person who actually caused the Doctor to reflect the tsunami wave.
Mm.
But I can't remember who it was.
Wasn't it the journalist?
It was. Then the journalist was called Janice Marston.
Janice Marston, yeah.
Yeah, with the whole thing of, oh, we're running out of food. That's why I drowned the Lake District.
I can't actually... Oh, it's been a while since I listened to the episode. I'm going to listen to it again soon.
It's just, I thought that was a bit of a pity me story. But apart, like putting that aside,
I don't mind that.
I really like, it was so good, the fact that it is essentially a trial court thing. And Doctor Who's always done it in the past. But when it's usually done, it can be a bit repetitive, it can be a bit boring. Trial of a Time Lord is a prime example. But the way this is done, I think... It's just really good. It's very engaging. I like how there's just so many things happen. There's snipers. There's androids. There's bombs going off. And it's
I think you hit the nail on the head when you said like every thread matters and ties together. And I must say, like, it seems like it would be so hard to write an episode where you've got so many seemingly disparate threads and they come together so beautifully. It's exactly the opposite of Flux. When you have so many threads set up and they all go nowhere or go somewhere stupid. Whereas this, you've got so many threads set up, admittedly not as many as Flux, but, you know, it's an episode, not a full series. You've got so many threads set up and they all draw together in them. Such a satisfying conclusion. I love it.
It is a supreme story. Mm. It's amazing all around. And I don't think it actually impacts... the rest of the series as well. The only sort of thing is, the further characterization of the Doctor and the further like rekindling of the relationship between Jason and the Doctor after.
I really like the difference between Jason sort of not talking to the Doctor for a bit and having like being very mad at her, and the whole discussion about no one should have that power. Whereas Damien goes, no, it was horrible, but I agree with you. You did what had to be done, and I think I love that duality. I love that both of those points, because the companions are audience surrogates, and like different audience members will have different opinions on whether what the Doctor did was right, and Jason and Damien represent those two different opinions in this story.
I really do like the whole thing of Damien is more someone who will just agree with the Doctor and say, yeah, you know, you clearly know more than me. Whereas Jason, it feels that because he's been with the Doctor a bit longer, he feels like he knows what the Doctor's all on about, but when he's faced with Lake drowning time.
And I love... Sorry, going back to the nuclear option for a moment. I love how Damien's going, she can't stop a tsunami. What's wrong with you? And he's going, you don't understand. She can. And that's something that's so often in Doctor Who. The companions just have blind faith in the Doctor and then they're justified in that. And it's a beautiful subversion of expectations and of tropes that he's wrong. And that no... she can't stop a tsunami. Yes, it's a magical sci-fi thing, but it doesn't save everyone. Anyway, sorry, back to Antarctic Accords. It's just a brilliantly done story.
I agree. Even though, yes, it does require nuclear option, I can sort of forgive it because the payoff, well, two payoffs, two very good endings, and cheers of wine. That's it's a great set of tales.
There's something that I'm not quite sure about, which was... like the character of Quinn, who being the discriminated minority, who then turns out to actually be villainous, almost partly because of that. I'm not.
Is it one of those ends justify the means sort of thing?
I don't know. It feels a bit like. But then, in some sense, in a story where everyone's the villain, it's not so much like you're singling it out. Like, and no one ever says in the story that the discrimination is in any way justified.
Mm.
Like, it's very much a case of like, it's horrible that you've been treated this way. I don't know. I don't know. I don't even know if it's a nitpick, but I don't know. It's a brilliant, brilliant episode.
Love in the Time of Maggie. 1982, the cusp of the Falklands War. The Doctor, Jason, and Damien work against a time traveller attempting to assassinate Margaret Thatcher, except one of them isn't too keen on the idea.
I do like this episode. It's a good episode.
I quite like this episode as well. With apart from one small thing, I think the villain is a bit of a wet fish, only because technically the villain isn't really the main villain. The main villain is supposed to be what Thatcher represents and her values and the conflict between her and Jason and the Doctor and Jason, which I fully understand. I fully understand that this person, Mary Windsor, who is planning on assassinating Margaret Thatcher because she's bad. Yes, thank you. Lovely critical analysis there, Mary. I'm not taking that away from Jason. I just felt that I really don't understand the motivations. I don't like the ending with, all right, you know, I give up, you know, maybe you.
And
I do like this story. I like the fact that we are actually in like the Prime Minister's office, and I love the reference to the ultimate adventure. What was going on there? But yeah,
I must say I disagree with what you're saying about the villain and his why, because Mary Windsor doesn't have a great deal of critical analysis going on. She just sort of is evil. Well, actually, she dislikes Margaret Thatcher, and there's a debate about is that actually bad. Which is sort of in the air. And I think the reason I don't mind that she doesn't have a very sort of critical, complicated political opinion or motivation, the fact is some people are like that. Some people don't think their actions through a great deal and don't have very thought-out political opinions, and they do just...
You're bad, you're good.
Yeah, that is what some people are like, and to me it feels quite real. And I love the ending, and here's why I love the ending. Two reasons. First of all, I love when the good guys win due to essentially persuading the bad guys rather than actually sort of tricking them or forcing them. It's something I love about the Zygon inversion. It's something I love about Battlefield. I love when the victory, especially in a show like Doctor Who, where the Doctor's weapons are words, not really the sonic screwdriver, let alone a gun. And the second reason I love it is because it's Damien who does it. Like, in like Moffat and Chibnall era, it very much, one of their weaknesses is the Doctor solves everything. The Doctor always solves everything. And in any Doctor Who episode, if it's not the Doctor solving everything, then usually it's the main companion. Damien is the secondary companion. Jason is the companion of the series, and Damien sort of dips in and out. And I love that he solves the story here. I love that he gets his moment in the limelight. Rory never ever gets a moment like Damien does in this episode. And I love that Damien solves it. And I think that's brilliant.
Wise words, Ollie. there was two things I want to say. One, Lorna as Margaret Thatcher.
Amazing.
Amazing voice. I can't believe it works. It works so well. What was going on there?
How were you that talented, Lorna?
I was
Lorna?
That talented. It was a very... And also, it's not just the fact that the voice acting is good. It's that what Lorna does with the character and the way that she's essentially using the policies, the sort of feelings of, you know, I'm, you know, what are you doing? You know, the Doctor says, what are you doing, Mrs. Thatcher? I'm going, hey, I'm going to govern. And it's that is the... It's not just the character of Thatcher. That is Thatcher there.
Yeah.
Which and I thought was... Goodness me.
Yeah, it's so good. I feel like this has something in common with R&R and with Mind Your Manners and with the character of Jason in general of being very, again, anti-capitalist, which is a big theme in the series, and I love it for it. I love the series.
The clash between Jason and Thatcher was pretty good. Mm. But what I felt was strange is that this is pre-Section 28, so essentially this is before Thatcher has really any time to implement but anti-gay policies.
It's sort of the point, because the point is that Jason wants to stop her doing that before she can. Mm. Like, that's sort of the whole conflict of the episode.
Well, I mean, then you got the whole thing of can you change time? I mean, we're not on Chalkboard now. We already did an episode on changing time. But
those of you who don't know, Chalkboard orders Louis Maths podcast.
Yay, shout out.
Shameless.
We did shout out Hoosop Pod on Chalkboard. So I think it's a fair deal now. There was a certain line about, what was it? The Falklands War doesn't need to happen, but 1983 election has to happen. Oh, what was the majority? 140? Does it have to be less? I was thinking, I like a bit of history. Do we need to focus on, yes, this election and this seat majority? It has to be this, exactly. I think it was. I think it's more funny than annoying. I just find it that there are...
The specific rules of time travel?
Yeah, but I think that's part of the fun stuff as Doctor Who. It was pretty funny listening to it and thinking, well, maybe some bits can be changed, but maybe if that leads to something else that is very important, then that has to stay the same. Her election in 1983 is a fixed one.
To be honest, the way I see it in Doctor Who, fixed points, there are very, very vague rules, but they're inconsistent all the time. And I think at this point, they're inconsistent enough that I don't mind that they're done in a particular way that's maybe a little bit contrived just for the purposes of it working in the context of this episode.
And of course,
I don't mind that at all.
I think it's not just that there's the context of the episode. This is the conflict. The conflict is, can you change time? Would you just allow Margaret Thatcher to be killed? And I like the thing of time put these people in their places to do their job. It's up to them to see what they can do. Mm-hmm. You can't start intervening. I mean, what is Jason going to say next? The laws of time are
not
his.
Not one line.
Exactly. There's a way of doing it, and I think the conflict between can you change time versus can you, I think is done very well.
I think the only thing that bothers me is that Jason is saying... Jason clearly doesn't want to save Margaret Thatcher, and the Doctor sort of implies that that's equivalent to killing her. Like, it's almost as if, in the Doctor's mind, Jason is suggesting... can we kill Margaret Thatcher, please? Which is not what he's saying. He's just saying don't intervene, which I feel like is a different thing and maybe could have been explored. But that's one specific facet, and I think everything else is done fantastically. I think it's a great episode for political discussion.
I agree.
And it also goes into the whole... like, again, it's the whole thing of addressing Jason's sort of sexuality and queerness.
Mm.
I think it's done excellently.
I agree. Let's move on.
Speeding up a little bit because we're running out of time in our slot.
Time is running out. Let's move on to what Ollie might be one of Ollie's favourite stories and one of my least favourite stories.
Oh, yes.
This being, if I could find it, The Rutan Stowaway and The Conquest of Sontar.
Probably easiest to talk about this in one go, partly for sake of time, partly because they're one very linked episode story.
The war between the Sontar and the Rutans have raged for 50,000 years. Today, trapped on a spaceship crashing towards the Sontar and homeworld, Sontar, the Doctor and Jason will find themselves right in the middle of it.
And I'm pretty sure Conquest of Sontar is the exact same description, but we'll find out why.
Indeed it is.
It's almost like I've read
of
the episode descriptions.
Kind of. I don't like this as much as Ollie does. In fact, I think this is the weakest part of Outer Shadows, which is annoying because the way it sets up the Minister of War, aka the series arc, is done so well, done so effectively, and how it sets up the whole loop in time, and I just don't find it as engaging. And this is going to sound very cruel, but we did say good faith criticism. I don't really care what's going on. I don't care. I think even for a two-parter, this goes very, very quickly, and like you're on the spaceship, and it crashes, and then oh my god, there are some Sontarans. Oh my god, there's a Rutan. Oh my god, we're splitting up. Oh right, and it's Kefola and all. I like the idea of trench warfare between planets, but the Minister of War does remind me of the war chief kind of, and the war lord, because you go, oh,
I've
we're training
the war games.
The whole thing of that is the war chief is taking humans out of time to make them fight in wars to see which is the best. I think I've heard this before. No offense, Jacob, but I actually quite like that it's similar to the warlord and what was going on in the war games. I'm saying the word war too much, aren't I? I would think the home planet of the Sontarans would be better defended. I think plot armor is surrounding some characters here.
I suppose in my mind, the Rutans never get to Sontar. And so, in my mind, the Sontarans focus all of their defense on outside of the planet and on sort of space battles and stopping the Rutans getting there in the first place. And there's laser monkeys and death sand and whatever, which, and like lots of Sontarans there. Personally, I don't have any issues with that. Maybe a tiny bit, but like not really. I can just... to me, that's justified just by the fact that it's made clear that the Rutans never even get that close to Sontar.
There's a part with like everyone's a Rutan, and you know, like everyone is pretending to be someone else. And I'm not saying this is awful. It's just that I didn't really enjoy this as much as the other ones. Which I think it's more the fact that I kind of like the idea that the Rutan on Sontaran conflict should be in the background, something hinted at as being an incredibly horrible, destructive thing, but we're not going to get engaged with it. I think the fact that as soon as you start talking about it, it's not going to be as good as you think it is. But the fact that it's on Sontar, I thought it'd be better. You know, okay, laser monkeys. Pew, pew, pew.
The laser monkey.
I also think
funny.
The Sontarans are written as funny, not as like, I don't really think that, oh, this is a very engaging thing, because the Sontarans are written in a humorous way. Now, to be fair, that's not, I wouldn't say that's the fault of Outer Shadows. It's more of a byproduct of what New Who has done to the Sontarans, which was kind of inevitable anyway, because they're always, oh, they're potatoes, oh, they're, you know, they're clones, they're very small. I'm not as excited for this one, but it does lead to a very good finale, so I can't really fault it much.
Whereas I absolutely love this story. I love its pieces. It's one of my favourite stories of the series. Again, me and Louis have flipped where Louis loves the early episodes and I'm not so keen, whereas Louis's not so keen on some of these later episodes, whereas I absolutely love them. I think, to me, starting on a crashing spaceship is classic Doctor Who. I love it. I think it's so fun. I love the crashing spaceship. I love them romping around on Sontar. I see what you mean about it's never as good as you expect, except for me, it kind of is. But also, I feel like we don't really focus on the war. We focus on humans and how they interact with the war. And I think fundamentally that's what makes it work, because we're seeing the effects of the war on other species. Fundamentally, it's not about the war or about one side winning over the other. It's about, like, trying to survive the war. It's about the humans and the Doctor and Jason trying to survive. And I think it's, I just love it. I think it's a really, really fun romp. I love the cliffhanger. I love Freya's delivery of the conquest of Sontar begins today. And I think it's really fun.
T's and C's apply. Coming to a store, the conquest of Sontar.
And I also love in part two all the shenanigans with the shape shifting and trying to work out which is the real Jason.
How does it end though? Because I really don't understand what the hell was going on. Like the whole Jomsky was doing something, and then
I don't know what's going on. Well, you've got the.
If only there was a Target novelization of it, Jake. If only.
Well, you've got the whole thing of, I mean, obviously, as you say, it sets up the story arc brilliantly. We properly meet the Minister of War and his motivations, which sets up the finale brilliantly, so the finale doesn't have to do loads of exposition. And I like setting up, I love the reveal of how the Sontaran Rutan War began. I feel like, you know, you don't want to retcon too many things in Doctor Who, but to me this is something which is important enough that it gives it gravitas, but not so important that you're messing with, like, major canon. Which I think is done well. And I also, I love the conflict at the end between the Doctor and Jason, which again sets up the reason for Jason leaving, where the Doctor essentially manipulated these characters into coming with her to stop the Sontarans and Rutans and activate the EMP and destroy the
technology. There's a deeper side to the Doctor. And like, it's not all excitable.
It's not as explicit as in the nuclear option, and I love that it's not just the same thing again, it's done differently, but we see her being manipulative in a way that we don't quite realise, and Jason calls her out on it, and I love it. I love this episode. I just love it so much. I think it's so fun, and I think it ends on a really brilliant note for their characters.
Excellent. The fourth wall, trapped inside a recreation of the Three Musketeers, the Doctor and Jason face battles against swordsmen, a many-handed alien scholar, and canon itself. Canon? Canon in my Doctor Who?
You might be able to tell we're speeding up slightly.
Let me just say, this is so much fun. This is so meta. I like it's a nice break before the finale.
I love the meta-ness of it.
But what the hell is going on? I have no clue what's going on. I've never read The Three Musketeers. I love the fact it's a crossover. What is going on? What's going on? Who the hell is Cardinal Richelieu?
I mean, the thing is, for me, I mean, I've also not read The Three Musketeers. I like that it's a crossover with Duad's Three Musketeers, because obviously, for those of you who don't know, Durham University Audio Drama Society has a Three Musketeers audio drama series. And the point was, this is a crossover between them, between their casts, and you've got like a special little intro music, which is done wonderfully. And I love the meta-ness of it. I've not read Three Musketeers, but I do think the fact that Jason hasn't read it makes that a lot better, because
is he my surrogate? I should be with Jacob, not Jacob, but Jacob. Why did you name him Jason? I'm getting confused. Yeah,
Jason's a good name. I like Jason.
I appreciate what this thing was trying to do, but I'm annoyed that my lack of familiarity with the Three Musketeers limits my enjoyment of it, because I think the idea of a collab, the idea of a full wheel break, I remember listening to this when it was going out and hearing the line from Evie, it's like an audio drama. I burst out laughing because you need that. You need
the metaness.
The metaness, the humour.
For an episode called The Fourth Wall, you've got to actually break the fourth wall a bit, which they do. And I, to be honest, for me, it's like Mind Your Manners in the fact that it's a really fun premise and they have loads of fun with it, but it's unlike Mind Your Manners in that I don't have nitpicks with bits of the plot to me don't quite make sense. It's just a fun romp. Like,
I also like the link with River Song and the whole thing of this is the library.
That is brilliant.
It was a lot better than going back to the Land of Fiction, because I think when it comes to Land of Fiction, yeah, it's just you would just want to bring every single fictional character that you know,
yeah,
and be like, ah, look at all this stuff we could do. But just putting it over in a book.
I think this is, I think it's a genius. If you were going to bring back River Song at all, which generally I'm against, but I'm not against it here because of the way it's done. And I think it's, I'm not going to go into it now because we're running out of time, but I think it's genius. And I also wanted to say I love the scene with where what's her name is trying to sort of seduce Jason to get him to free her. And he's like, I'm gay as all hell. That's not going to work on me. And I love the scholar who's sort of like, you're ruining the plot.
It, yeah.
You can't be gay. It's a hilarious story.
And you need it. You need it for a very dark, serious finale, which we will get to now. Eternal War and Against the Dying of the Light. Once again, Earth faces peril of the Shadow Men.
No!
In a mass invasion force, the Doctor and Jason must ask themselves, just who is the Minister of War? What does he want with humanity?
This story as a whole is my favourite story of the series. If we're going to split them episode by episode, Against the Dying of the Light is my favourite episode of the series. Eternal War would be probably somewhere in the middle.
I have some things to say about
why.
This. And I'll agree, this is a very good finale, but I've just ruined it now. It's very good, but I think Eternal War is good, but that's as far as I'm going to go. There's a lot of running around. Surely the Doctor sees it's a trap. Now, to be fair, Out of Service, which I really, really do like, is also a trap, but I think it's done in a better way. Like, why are we going around the whole world and, like, you know, just messing about and, oh, we're here. It does feel like a Chibnall thing of, you know, you could see you could see the title saying, we are now in Stockton, UK. I feel bad. Sorry, Jacob.
Oh, no. As soon as you said Chibnall, it became a person. I'm joking.
The fact that UNIT do feel a bit like placeholders. They feel like, oh, UNIT are here. Oh, no. Saucers appeal. No, saucers? Yes. Flying saucers appearing around the world. Oh, no. Better call UNIT. Bah, 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 bah. I am UNIT.
I like the UNIT. I think they're good in this episode. They don't take a central role, but I think that's fine.
I think I agree. The fact that this is a very good setup. And I also like...
And if hypothetically UNIT were to appear in the next series, this is a good way of setting up the characters.
I agree. I love the cliffhanger, though. I love the cliffhanger, though. The cliffhanger is such a moment of, what are we going to do? The Doctor disappears. Oh, my life. What are we going to do? And what it does to Jason as well. And you could see the starting of a resistance movement within Earth, that, you know, these characters in Stockton, they're gonna somehow save the world, which of course is what happens after the episode ends. We move into Against the Dying of a Light.
I think my thing with Eternal War is I think the beginning is great. I love having I love the Minister of War's speech, and I love their little conversation in the TARDIS about why do aliens keep coming to Stockton? It's rubbish. I think that's funny, but then explained really succinctly. And then immediately meeting the Minister of War, and he's so calm and relaxed about letting the Doctor in on his plans and looking around the ship. And I think that's actually genius, having such a calm villain who doesn't care.
The man's got better things to do.
And he's like, you can't stop. Like, He's seen everything the Doctor can do and has done, and he's still like, I don't care, you can't stop me. There's literally nothing you can do, and that's terrifying. And the middle is maybe a bit naff. Maybe naff's a bit of a harsh word. Jacob says in the Outer Shadows Confidential for this episode that he had to sort of fill it, and he wasn't quite sure how to fill a full episode of setup of like stuff before the part two, something to that effect. You can sort of tell, like, it's also it. The two doctors is fun, but I'm not sure how much. I love the doctor meeting themselves. It's fun, but I'm not sure how much it contributes to the plot.
We love when the doctor meets themselves.
And I think, but then the ending of this episode is amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. The way the cliffhanger
okay,
works.
Yeah. Did she really not see there was a trap coming a bit sooner? Anyway, but once we get into it, once he's like, we've got a second set of ships, and we're gonna leave Swansea because you actually destroyed one of them. I think it's really really fun. I love having a cliffhanger where everything really properly goes wrong. Everything is screwed, and you're like, oh,
but
goodness.
There's a part two, Ollie. So clearly everything went okay.
Well, yes. I mean, I also, it's yeah. It's time to play the music. Like,
yeah.
Like, the Richard Sharpe's creepy Minister of War voice is amazing. Everything about the final bit is done perfectly. And just when you think it couldn't get worse, you get, yeah, the little dum, 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 dum. And it's like, is this on Tarn architecture? And you can hear this. And you know it's the Daleks because you can hear the little musical cue. And then you hear them and you're like, oh my God, it's. It couldn't possibly get a worse situation, and it has done, and it's so, so good.
I think Against the Dying Light is a very good follow-on and what it does. But what my issue is with this, the very end, how this ends, is that it feels like it's asking more questions than it answers. Hmm. It's clearly hinting that, oh, this is what we're going to be doing in season two. Oh, look, it's what was her name?
Vilvella.
Vilvella, yeah.
Vilvella.
Villa.
I love Against the Dying of the Light. I have almost no bad words to say against the Dying of the Light.
But I really do love what Jason and Damon get up to in their resistance and what they're trying to do and how they're working with people like Wilson and Bernie and Tommy. This is what Doctor Who is about. It's about the people. It's not necessarily about the Doctor and the whole. There are two Doctors going around. I think it's done quite well. The Doctor reads poetry as well. We love poetry
brilliant.
In Doctor Who, don't we, Ollie? I think it was pretty good. In the forest.
This is actually done really well.
When the way that Jason's arc is concluded, I think, where he says, all right, you know what? I've got a place to settle down. I've had my time. I'm leaving you.
And I think it's so brilliant how all hope is lost. And Jason has been built up to be throughout this whole series of he's finally feeling at home and he's finally happy. And you have this little fun episode and everything comes crashing down. And everything is ruined for him. And he's doing his best to do something. And it's so, like, traumatic. And it's so done perfectly. And then he does... And he sort of has negative agency if he gets one of his friends killed. But that's such a brilliantly done scene. The sound design of the, like, the bone crunching is horrible. And done amazingly, and would probably not be PG if we saw it on screen. But because it's an audio drama, you can get away with it. And it's, oh my God. And then, I don't mind that he has negative agency because he is the one who resolves the plot. And I love the fact that we've had two ways of defeating the shadows throughout the series. And the Doctor's using one way of regeneration energy, and the Minister of War has brilliant bouncing off the Doctor in terms of the character, and like, you always are going to self-sacrifice and then something stops you. And I love that he brings that up because, of course, it always has to happen. Like, the Doctor has to live on. That's how the show works.
Just this once.
But I love that. I love that he actually addresses that. And I love how you can actually... I just love this in finales. And I mentioned this when we were talking about Out of Service earlier. I love when you can see the solution coming.
Mm.
And you don't, because I don't see the solution coming at all, but you can, because it happened.
The beats are there throughout the story.
8 episodes ago.
It's built, I mean, I know what you said about Jacob filling Eternal War, but you can see that this is the this is the conclusion of the series. It's done perfectly the way it wraps up. With
in terms of
characters,
plot and character.
The Minister of War, the fact that we see the return of Pog and Bram and the Unknown Shade. And everything wraps up together.
All of the things that are to do with the Minister of War are in this two-parter. And, yeah, I love the concept of these Eternals are pitching these different races against each other. The Daleks and the Mavellans are really fun. And you know something's going to happen with Phil Vella in Series 2. And I'm so excited to see what that is. Because obviously, I know I'm in Series 2. I'm only in 3 episodes and I've not read the other scripts. And I'm so excited to find out what happens. I'm so excited for that.
Me too. But it's going to be absolutely hectic because we got one series of Doctor Who coming out and then our series of Doctor Who coming out. But then again, that's the society. And
I think the one thing I will nitpick at, the one, because I know I said I don't always know criticisms. The one thing I will nitpick at is the Daleks could be a bit scarier than the Doctor just jumping down a little shaft and going, oh, you're supposed to be the most dangerous race in the universe. Try following me. Bye-bye. But whatever. It is whatever. The Daleks are scary as a whole in this episode. There's just a few moments.
And with that, I think we'll wrap up and we'll head to questions. Now, this technically wasn't a question that was asked, but we're going to have to ask it anyway. Top 3 stories. Although you might go stories, episodes, and put all the...
Let's go episodes. My top 3. My third favourite is Conquest of Sontar. I just think it's so fun. And then Open Doors. Open Doors is a very close 4th. The Nuclear Option. That speech at the end blows everything out of the park. And then Against the Dying of the Light, because it's, I think, pretty much the perfect conclusion. It's, I think, in a way, almost no, even RCD and Moffat finales, and I love the both of them, do things brilliantly, but apart from The Doctor Falls, there's, to me, always nitpicks and always gripes and always flaws. I have nothing significant that's negative about this episode. To me, it's the perfect Doctor Who finale, and it's fan-made, and obviously Chibnall's rubbish.
I would say Out of Service, because I really enjoyed the return to Earth, seeing what Damien's like and the fun shenanigans that go on with the Shadows improving themselves. Then I'd go Antarctica Accords, because I know, yes, it includes Nuclear Options somehow. However, the characters, the motivations, the fun that is going on with the Doctor trying to solve this mystery, I think was very, very cool. And then, of course, Mighty Manners, because it's amazing. I love Mighty Manners.
I love that we've got completely different top 3 episodes. We've got a Jacob episode and a wine episode, a Jacob episode.
Truly the peak of mine and Ollie's opinions.
I can't describe how much I love Against the Dying of the Light.
We do have some questions. What alien would you like 14 to meet? And they're in brackets again.
Trouble is, I mean, in terms of ones she's not... Thing is, I know enough about the series. I know what aliens she meets, so I don't know how to sort of talk about it without spoilers. I'm just going to say my favourite Doctor Who villain is the Cybermen, but I think they're often done really badly in Doctor Who. And I know whether the Cybermen are in it or not, and I'm not going to reveal, but I would really like them to be in it because I would like to see how they are written for this series, and that's all I'm going to say.
I agree. I quite like the Cybermen as well. What other companions do you think have the best dynamic with 14?
What other companions?
Yeah, just give a few names, Ollie.
I think anyone who would call 14 out, Yaz would call 14 out, but in a really annoying, gripey way.
Martha, I could see call 14 out.
Martha and Donna. Martha and Donna are great for calling the Doctor out and for having that kind of conflict.
I mean, Tegan's whole thing is it stopped being fun. When would Tegan say it stopped being fun with the 14th Doctor?
The Nuclear Option, probably. I don't know. I don't know. I could really see Martha or Donna having... I would love to see an episode with Donna and 14. I would love that so much.
I agree. It would be interesting because...
Also, Bill.
Oh, Bill. Yeah,
well, I'd love to see Bill and 14.
Because Donna is a character who gets on very well with 10. And it'd be interesting to see 14 as sort of having that spin on 10 of being the darkness.
Yeah, but she clashes with 10... But I think she would clash a lot more with 14 because of the way that she is. I mean,
Donna and Bill both have that sass and that wit about them that would make them play off really well against the characterization of the 14th Doctor.
I agree. If you could meet one, not meet, if you could choose one cast member who you would wanted to see in a bigger role, who would it be? Hands down, Jacob Frater. I really liked him.
Wait, which role does he play?
He plays the hologram in Love for Simon Maggie. Yeah. And he also plays, I think, one of the news presenters at Antarctic Records. Mm. I just find his roles very funny. And I want to see him in a bigger part. But I thought it was just so funny. The hologram is... I don't know... Again, this is the whole thing with Mary Windsor. I don't know what exactly it is, but having a hologram, so like just this weird hologram saying random stuff, I think is pretty funny. And I quite like the voice, so I'd like to see Jacob Frater.
Yeah. I don't really know. I don't really have a good answer to that. I do love, maybe I'm biased because he's a particular friend of mine, but I do love Joe's performances. I think he has a particular niche with how he performs things, but I love his Calipari and I love Quinn.
I do like Quinn as well.
I think he's just really fun. His performances just feel sort of unique and authentic in a really fun way.
We have another question. When are we getting a character option toy of a real 14th Doctor Sonic Screwdriver?
I want this so much. And now in the 37 special episode, in the poster, you see a picture of it and we know what it looks like now. And I want it. And I want a purple Sonic Screwdriver. Why are there no purple Sonic Screwdrivers in televised Doctor Who? And I love how it looks so much. It's a brilliant design. Credit to the artist. I'm not sure who it was. Was it Joe, Jacob's boyfriend? I'm not sure.
I think it was.
Yeah. Anyway, whoever it was, credit to you. Amazing. I love it.
Well, with that, I think we're going to have to end our Who's Views. The first ever Who's Views we've ever done. But hopefully we'll be getting more out there. There's many opinions and controversial views held in our Doctor Who society. So it would be cool to hear what people want to say, whether it be for a few minutes or a few hours. I'm going to leave it at that. Well, it's goodbye from me. Goodbye from Ollie.
Goodbye. And I think the central message to take away from this podcast is Out of the Shadows is bloody brilliant.
I agree.
Purple Radio Podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.